from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Tibetan Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman was 23 years old when he first met the Dalai Lama. The spiritual leader made Thurman a monk, the first known Westerner to take the vows. But Thurman would ultimately leave the monastery to become a scholar and activist. Now a professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist studies at Columbia University, he joins us to talk about his latest book, Man of Peace, the illustrated life story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. That's next on Forum. Join us. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, you're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Celebrated Tibetan Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman has a new book about the Dalai Lama, and it's a graphic novel called Man of Peace, the illustrated life story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. The book details the spiritual leader's struggle for peace and justice for the Tibetan people. Thurman's friendship with the Dalai Lama goes back 53 years. He was 23 years old when he first met the Dalai Lama after he dropped out of Harvard to explore the mysteries and complexities of Buddhism. Robert Thurman, welcome to Forum.
Oh, thank you, Mina. You described things so nicely.
Thanks.
That's so really nice.
I just described that you're a Harvard dropout. So why was Harvard so unsatisfying?
Oh, well, Harvard is really not unsatisfying. It's really quite a nice place. But later I discovered when I came back to graduate school and studied Chinese that the Chinese term for Harvard, Hafu Daoxue, means actually this University of the Laughing Buddha. But the Hafu, although it's just a phonetic, some wag, you know, some humorous person in the 19th century picked for phonetics Ha, which is to laughing, and Fo, which means a Buddha. So then it is the University of the Laughing Buddha, and I kind of like that. But what it is Western culture. I did not find it entirely satisfying. And I didn't really know why, and I was whatever. I just felt like I was not in the right culture. And what happened is when I discovered the Tibetan and Sanskrit alphabets, and I realized that there were some people in the world who had logical alphabets, and they knew what was going on when we move our lips and tongue and teeth and breathe and make noises that are language. You know, they have this very organized alphabets that are marvelous. And I learned that a consonant has no sound unless a vowel departs from it, you know, which we never think. We think A, B, C, you know, and C is not really C, it's K, and A is a vowel, and it's not really A, it's A. And B has the vowel E going, leaving the B, you know. And if you try to say B without a vowel, all you can do is like, mm. And it was a thrill to feel that some people kind of knew what speaking was about better than we did. All we do is memorize A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P. And we follow that leader, you know, without understanding what we're doing. So I just didn't feel Harvard had, you know, they didn't have the philosophy, they didn't have the psychology, they just couldn't figure things out quite, you know, it's all their brilliance, you know, completely contrary to, of course, Western people who feel that we're the avant-garde, you know. And I like to tease my Buddhist studies professors, friends, and I tell them that, of course, you guys, you're very weirded out about all these people for millions of years, thousands, millions of people for thousands of years who've been studying Buddhism. Because you know that Buddha couldn't have been enlightened because he didn't have a PhD from Harvard.
What was it like when you met the Dalai Lama for the first time at 23
years
old?
Well, when I met him for the first time, I wasn't too impressed, I must admit, because I had been studying already for a couple of years with an old Mongolian gentleman in his 60s who had been many years in Tibet from Mongolia, you know, and was, I think, basically really enlightened person. Certainly he was very clairvoyant about what was going on in my mind because he could find me at 3 a.m. behind a tree outside from his little monastery in New Jersey and prevent me from meditating because he had a big thing about me not meditating. I don't know why. I do know why now, but I didn't then. And he was really impressive, you know, but he was very, very friendly and low-key, you know, and he washed dishes and whatever, cooked. But he really knew what was about the mind. Whereas Dalai Lama was a young guy. He was only 6 years older than me, 29. And he was, of course, His Holiness Dalai Lama, and he was sweet and friendly, and people were really respecting him because of his office. But, you know, he didn't really teach me much at that first time. He kind of took charge of me, and he referred me to his teachers, and he examined me to be a monk and made me a monk at my, you know, insistence. Although the old Lama told him, don't make him a monk. He wants to be a monk. He's all gaga about being a monk, but he's not going to end up being a monk. He's
Why not make him a monk?
Well, I think he understood at Merit Western Society. Dalai Lama had just escaped a few years before. And, you know, the little bubble of the refugee community, they were living like Tibet, where it's the most normal thing to be a monk. It's like a privilege, and it's easy. You don't worry about not having a date or something like that. And, you know, they have a lot of monasteries, and they respect you, and you get your free lunch from them very happily, you know, the people in the Buddhist society, you know. Whereas in America, we don't even, you know, the Protestant ethic, no free lunch, you know. And so, you know, being a monk, there's no support for that, you know. And also, you know, since previous life I probably was Mongolian or Tibetan or something, why I had the affinity for that. I wouldn't have been reborn in America, in New York City, if I was, you know, determined to be a monk. But once I started studying, since being a monk in a Buddhist society is like getting a MacArthur Fellowship for life, you know.
How?
And you can just study and meditate and teach and
so
do whatever you want.
A life of research.
And you get that free lunch, you see, from the people. And people are happy to give it to you. They don't feel you're like you're no good for nothing, you know.
So the Dalai Lama does make you a monk, but then you leave the monastery.
I read he
was upset with you for that.
He was. So. He thought, well, some other Tibetans who were annoyed with me, because I was very annoying at that age. I was extremely annoying. I learned to speak Tibetan in 10 weeks, and I became fluent right away. And then I wanted, you know, I was into the philosophy of it, and I wanted to debate with everybody, you know. And then they were a little more relaxed, you know, it was their natural culture and everything. I'd come in and like, you know, what's the meaning of emptiness? You know, I would really irritate them. So some of them who went back, they kind of told him, oh, I was a hippie, and I was like freaked out and whatever. And he didn't realize that instead I had made a choice that I had to really integrate in American society to do anything useful. So I wanted to go to university, et cetera. And you know, there's civil rights. You know, my friends were marching in the civil rights thing. And then some of them were too stoned to march in any rights thing. And I wanted to save them from being stoned, teach them to meditate. You know, so I wanted to be active among my peers, you know. And my Mongolian Lama, who had never wanted me to be a monk, he kept saying, Why are you trying to be a monk? You know, like, and A and B, you can't leave my monastery and go out and march and protest the war, you know. And he was kind of conservative, like immigrants can be, you know. He was like worried about the communists also, having seen Mongolia and Russia and China and the whole thing go under communism. And so, you know, there was just no support for it, you know. So I decided in order to develop beyond a certain point, I needed to be engaged in life and do something, you know. And I had been married before, very young I married. But for whatever reason, I fell in love with somebody else, which was a big crime, actually. It's terrible because we had a daughter. But anyway, I did fall in love with a model. And we were voted least likely to succeed, the ex-monk and the ex-model. What is this, you know? How can that work? And we just had our 50th anniversary, you know.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks to the Dalai Lama, probably. I probably would have been a crappy husband, more of a crappy husband, had I not had a little monk training for a short time, you know.
We're talking with Tibetan Buddhist scholar and activist Robert Thurman about his new graphic novel, Man of Peace, the illustrated life story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. Why do his story as a graphic novel?
I know. Well, maybe we made a mistake. Some literary people said you should call it a graphic biography because it really is a kind of biography. But the reason we called it a novel is that we had to elaborate some things, imagine them, and we wanted His Holiness to have deniability, you know. And also, in the Tibet movement nowadays, you know, the Tibet exiles, there are those who have fallen for the sort of lost cause motif about it. You know, they feel it's hopeless, you know, never China will crush them.
It's hopeless, meaning that they will not be able to be a sovereign nation again.
They'll never be free again. They'll not have their culture. Chinese communists will crush them forever. And they've been very oppressive since there was a brief opening in the 80s. And then from Deng Xiaoping through Jiang Zemin through Hu Jintao, it's been extremely oppressive. And even the first term of Xi Jinping, he didn't change it. So those people, they are what we call the appeasement faction. And they think that, you know, Chinese are so special, and they freak out if they lose face. So you can't embarrass them in any way, and then they'll just get mad. And so if you show them doing nasty things in Tibet like they did, when they'll tell the true story, then you're kind of provoking them, you know, in some way, and it'll be bad for the Tibetans. So we didn't want His Holiness to, you know, I know him really well. He could have been an authorized graphic novel and all this, but I didn't want him to be responsible for it in case it happened. Although, finally, as it turned out, I was worrying too much, because he did say around the time we finally came out with it, he said, in France, in the parliament, he said, the French, you know, are not so intimidated by the Chinese about letting him come and take him to the parliament and so on. And so he said, as other countries are, like the British, you know. And he said, it's so bad in Tibet that Tibetans are burning and they cannot even show their smoke, he said. And therefore, it's up to people who know the true story, who are outside and free to speak, to tell what goes on there, you know. That it's like an ethnocide, you know. I made up that word, but I love that word. It's a good word, ethnocide. It's better than ethnic cleansing, I think. Ethnocide. It's one step short of genocide, but it's close to it.
Yes, actually, I've heard that word used as well. But I guess the article, there was an article in the New York Times which it discussed your 50 years of marriage, but it suggested that the book was aimed at millennials, that in some way you were trying to newly popularize the Dalai Lama with a younger generation, and you felt like a graphic novel would be the best way to do
well,
it.
That's Is that also, an accurate that, statement? That was part of the original vision, but actually we've had a lot of feedback from adults that, I read this autobiography and that. There's two autobiographies out there of the Dalai Lama by himself, just words, you know. And they said, but I sort of ran out of steam halfway through the life, you know, and I read the interesting dialogues with Mao and with Nehru and things like that. But then I kind of ran out of steam. And nobody really knows the long struggle, you know, going to different countries and the complexities of it. For example, people assume, I think, that he's sort of a guru and he's out there getting followers. And they don't really notice, or it doesn't imprint them on their mind, that he's very clear he doesn't want to convert anybody to Buddhism. He's against that. You know, there are all these Dharma centers everywhere, but he's against that. He says, we should not be converted each other's followers. You know, we have Jew Boos and we have Chris Boos. We don't have many Chris Boos. We don't have many Hin Boos. No Mu Boos. Mus Boos, you know, Muslim Buddhists. You know, there's a lot of Jew Boos, actually. But he wants them all to stay with grandma's religion, Dalai Lama does. And he goes to the Christians and the Muslims and the Hindus and he says, please don't try to convert the Buddhists. Because in modern time, everybody's in these cities. There's temples, synagogues, temples, mosques, whatever. And if we start religious competition for market share today, it's going to lead to violence and danger, and it's going to be an excuse for demagogues, and it's really not good, you know. And so he doesn't want to set that example, like I'm going out and converting a lot of Buddhists. So he says, if you learn something from me about your mind, and about how to manage your own emotions or the meaning of life or whatever it is, then integrate that in your Christianity or your Judaism or your Hinduism or your Taoism or whatever it is, or your secular humanism. He treats that as a world religion. And stick with whatever doesn't upset grandma. He says that. He does. And then he, you know, if he's giving that talk in the talk and I happen to be around, he'll see someone like me, some pathetic person like me, and he'll say, well, some people can't help themselves, you know, as far as becoming a Buddhist. So, you know, and but that's great. For example, that's
grandmas.
A subtlety. He's so amazing in his sort of choices about things and his view of the world and history. And so my motive always is in writing about him. I wrote a book previously, this called Why the Dalai Lama Matters, which is just words, but which this sort of follows on to show him mattering, you know. And people are, oh, he's so nice. Oh, I love him. He's so sweet. Yes, his religion is kindness and it's nice and open-heartedness and all of that, you know, his things that he does. But they don't, and then they say, oh, but politics, oh, nonviolence, that doesn't work. Oh, Tibet is in a terrible condition. Oh, it'll never work. And he's kind of naive about the world and, you know, he can't really follow that sort of thing. People are like that who know very well. And meanwhile, my response to them is, well, he's more gentle in his responses, but my response to them is, how are they doing in Afghanistan with violence? Have they done well in the last 50 years or in the Middle East? You know, so nonviolence has not overthrown the Chinese occupation and colonialization of Tibet. But there's a chance still for dialogue with the rulers of China or some generation of them at some time when they might wake up to the idea that soft power, it means soft power. It doesn't mean hard power and then pretend to be nice. You know, it means you, when something's in your power, you're nice to them. You know, you don't crush them, and you can. You know? When, if you're not crushing something that you can't crush anyway, that's not a big piece of soft power, if you follow me. You know, like they're learning in Hong Kong, but then now they're getting a little impatient there, and they're not accepting a little individualism in Hong Kong, you know, that they did for a while, you know. So the key is, I'm sure that the brilliant, intelligent Chinese people, with all of their great, you know, natural abilities, will eventually understand that it's better to be part of the world and interact with people and be friendly and be known as friendly and be trusted by people and liked by people, actually, not feared and, like, catered to. And people think they got a market there or something, they're going to get something out of you. But actually, be part of the world and have a happy time with other people.
Still, you like to make the point that it's not like Buddhist leaders or Tibetan Buddhist leaders are saying that the Tibetan people cannot defend themselves.
Yes, no, they did. Against the Dalai Lama's wishes, they had a guerrilla warfare. They fought bravely with, overwhelmed and underarmed. And, you know what I mean? The CIA did a little minor support to some of them for a while. Even Dalai Lama's brothers went against his wishes. You know, Tibetans are very warrior-like, you know, and very, and their self-control and Buddhist thing of nonviolence is not something that comes that naturally to, especially Eastern Tibetans are particularly known as cowboys, you know, the Khambas, what they call the Khambas. And they were, you know, they fought back plenty, you know. And he tried to get them not to, and he never did, like, you know, declare jihad, you could say, you know. Buddhism kind of doesn't have a jihad thing, you know. Because they don't get into this absolute deity thing. They're not atheistic. They have the gods. They like gods. They, you know, it's nice to be a god, but they think humans are more lucky to study, have a better opportunity to study than gods. But they're not against the existence of gods. They just don't think there's one all-powerful one who's in charge of and responsible for everything. So therefore, when they get, you know, when they want to fight, they can't really use the religion very well. You can't get on your horse and say, "For emptiness," you know, what? Which direction are you going, you know? It a little bit takes the wind out of your sails. However, to defend themselves, Buddhist nonviolence involves self-defense. You're allowed very much to defend yourself if defending yourself could work. If it's so overwhelming, that sort of a last charge, you know, a fatal charge against the enemy, killing some of them before they waste you, that's stupid, because then the enemy gets more mad and then they kill more people, and you're not minimizing the violence. So you can be, there is surgical violence, in other words, in Buddhist nonviolence, but it's practical, you know. And Dalai Lama realized it never would work in the case of, in addition to, he was against it and he was inspired by Gandhi, but still he also realized it would never work, you know, 6 million people against 1.2 billion. Although when Mao invaded, there were only 600 million, actually, 600-700 million. The population has grown so fast.
You know, John Oliver of Last Week Tonight did a really funny segment earlier this year related to the Dalai Lama. But what I thought was particularly interesting was at the very beginning, he's talking with people on the street about who the Dalai Lama is. And they're, you know, saying the things that you describe, a very nice man, very charismatic, says good things.
Yes.
And then he asks them what the Dalai Lama does. And yes, there's, and so you have talked about how there have been biographies written about the Dalai Lama, many of them. What are you feeling like really needs to be shared about his life story that just doesn't, that people just aren't aware of,
right,
that you think is particularly relevant today?
Yes. Well, see, what I feel it is important, and especially to us nowadays, where our own country is being governed by idiots, you know. And so
you're,
especially
you're
important
positions,
for us,
Robert,
you know?
Thurman, yes.
And we're in trouble, you know. We're being occupied by, like, some weirdos, you know. And so, and it's therefore the natural tendency we have from media and so forth to feel despaired and that we're powerless and with no point even voting because they're all so terrible, all this kind of thing. So he's an example in the world of someone who doesn't get despaired, who remains optimistic, who resists cheerfully and joyfully and doesn't even hate the enemy, you know, resists and wants to correct them because it's bad for them to be nasty, but doesn't hate them, you know, and want to just, you know, shoot them or something, wants them to change, actually, and thinks that that's, if you persist at that, it will work in the long run. And I wanted people to see that, you know, and to know what the Dalai Lama stands for in the world and why people love the Dalai Lama, not just that he's cute or something, you know. That's not, you know, Buddha himself said, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha himself said years ago, he said, oh yeah, I know everything and I'm really happy and you can be happy if you learn what you are and what's going on in life, you know, like a sort of science thing, you know, you have to educate yourself and do that. He says, but don't believe what I'm telling you necessarily, because some other person will come and say they know everything and they'll tell you some nonsense. What I'm telling you is try this and that. If it makes you feel better, then you can begin to give me a little credibility. So, you know, I wanted them to know that Dalai Lama, like that, has useful services for people, you know. He really reminds us, he taught me, what religions really are supposed to be is service industries. They're not ownership industries, you know. They don't own their believers. They serve their believers. So the whole thing that the power of religion and the importance is to get more market share is a mistake. It's an imperialist type of behavior of an institution by people who were founded by people who were there to serve other people, to be happier, have a better life, be nicer to each other, you know, really fulfill the potential of the human condition, which is a soft, gentle friendliness, open-heartedness like human beings are, you know. Soft skin we have, you know. We don't have nails and claws and fangs, you know. We can invent them worse than animals, but we are basically gentle types, you know.
Human beings are, as you say, and we certainly have a capacity for compassion, but do you feel like, well, what role do you feel like compassion is playing right now? Do you feel like we have a compassion crisis?
Yeah, no, I don't think we have a compassion crisis, actually. What I feel is, I mean, the people who are misleading the different countries in the world have a compassion crisis. But the people in the world with the information, you know, the Facebook, with the everybody knows everything, where everybody's starving or where everybody had an earthquake or where everybody fell in a hole. Everybody knows all of that, you know, now. And where, you know, where some women are being tortured or tormented, they know. And they then hide it from themselves maybe or live in denial. But, you know, the people, the Dalai Lama himself taught me this, you know. Like in 1900, nobody questioned that war is really important and everybody has to do war. And you know, you got to have a war. You got to have a big army and it's not cool, right? Except not the Tibetans and Mongolians who have suffered because of that. But they ever know that. They knew that. But in 2000, everybody knows that war is useless. Nobody wins it. All the worst, best you can get is crush another country and have some terrorists come and blow up your airplanes. You know, that's all you get out of it. You don't. The original theory of war, that war is you defeat the army and then you go get the civilians to make some, you know, rice for you and give you a cheap price on the rice, whatever, you know. That's what it has a purpose, in other words. But now, Powell doctrine, don't go to war unless you're going to obliterate the enemy country. And then if you do, then what are they going to do for you? Nothing, because you killed their grandmother, you killed their daughter, you destroyed their house, you know, their everything, their sewage system. Then they're going to come and blow up your city and knock down your tower and whatever. They're going to want to, and they're going to succeed because the individual is so empowered by technology today, or they're going to hack your computer, you know. And you can't win a war. So everybody knows that now. But the governments, the leaders, who are these guys who are the brown nosers in life at school. They're the ones who didn't have fun, who weren't nice to the other students, the bullies, and because they were unhappy.
Well, I need to interrupt you just for a moment our listeners know that we'll have more with Tibetan Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman after the break and take your calls and questions. I'm Mina Kim in for Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Tibetan Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman has a new graphic novel about the Dalai Lama called Man of Peace, the illustrated life story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet, which he wrote with William Myers and Michael Burbank. It details the spiritual leader's struggle for peace and justice for the Tibetan people. And Thurman's friendship with the Dalai Lama goes back 53 years. What are your questions for Robert Thurman? You can give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. On Facebook, you can tweet us at KQED Forum, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. And Robert Thurman will also be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco today at 12:30 p.m. Robert Thurman, I mentioned that you've known the Dalai Lama for 53 years.
Yes.
In putting this book together, though, did you learn anything new about him or gain new insights through the process?
Yes, I did. You know, actually, you did. I didn't really properly answer your earlier question about it. You know, the thing is, in his autobiographies, the Dalai Lama, you know, his basic default personality setting is simple, humble Buddhist monk. So he won't present himself as doing anything like heroic or prophetic, you know, speaking truth to power, although he does, but he won't present himself like that. He says, well, we were just chatting, me and Mao and me and Nehru and me and Nixon or whatever. I didn't meet Nixon, but Nixon didn't have that fortune. But he met the Bushes and things like that. And so we wanted to show really the fact that this nonviolent person, this cheerful person, friendly person who makes people happy, is reacting to extreme persecution and violence, you know, on behalf of his people. And he's very sensitive to that. You know, he's like that thousand-armed Kanon, you know, Kanon Bosatsu, you know, Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara with his thousand arms reaching out everywhere. He really is like that. His sensitivity is like that. Why people like him, because he sees their point of view and listens to them and so on. So anyway, that was the thing. Now, what I learned was I really learned how fantastically persistent and brave and intelligent he is and how he really is presenting the prescription for how we can get out of the mess, you know. Basically, the prescription is, you know, what is our problem is we're too greedy and we have this industrial consumerism, and we're too angry and we have industrial militarism. And with the militarism, you know, we could destroy the planet in like an hour or two, you know, with the nuclear thing, you know. And with the consumerism, we are destroying it in a few more decades, you know, with the global warming. And so what we have done is we have developed our outer power over nature, but not our inner power over ourselves. And then migrating to the top of our pyramids of our societies are people who are the least self-developed often, you know, and who are the most, as I said, bullies and brown noses. And so they're behind where the people's sensibility at large is. And for example, take women. You know, women are key to managing this situation, because they are more interpersonally aware and sensitive. They're more naturally compassionate than the male. I'm not saying it's a generality, but they are. You know, which man is going to have an uninvited, you know, like a squatter in their belly for 9 months without paying rent? And then they get to know him, and then they're their beloved baby. But before that, it's just a stranger in there, and it's kind of interfering with their yoga sessions, you know what I mean? And it's a little bit, it's a heavy labor. You know?
Well, there are exceptions to every rule, but it sounds like you're saying that women need to be given or take on much more influential roles.
Absolutely. Angela Merkel, for example, saving the European Union. And we should have had, the election was won, the popular vote was won by our own Angela Merkel for all of her faults and problems and people being annoyed with her. She nevertheless won the election, even in spite of the stupidity of not having Bernie as her vice president, which she should have done. But she didn't do that. Democratic politics is messed up, where they don't take the runner-up automatically as the vice president, which they should do. Then they'd have more people out of the gate. You know, they'd have more support. But no, we don't need to do that because we don't think carefully. So never mind. That's a digression. But my point is, Buddhist point of view, and which Dalai Lama taught us, is that, you know, enlightenment doesn't mean some light going off in your head or, you know, playing some sort of parlor trick of having lights radiate out and having people worship you or something like that. Enlightenment means you are compassionate to others. You understand, you expand your sense of identification. You love other beings and you feel how they feel and what they think. And therefore, in that sense, women are ahead of the men, you know. As you know, I mean, look, you are one. I'm just slightly trained by a Swedish wife, you know, a Valkyrie that has like slowly taught me. My third great guru in life was my wife. And although she doesn't accept me really as a disciple yet, I'm still a novice. But I have learned that. And that is in the Buddhist teaching, actually.
Well, we have our listeners who'd like to speak with you. And let me go to the phones. Let's go to Kurosh in Nevada. Am I saying your name correctly?
That's perfectly correct. Thank
Great.
You.
What's your question?
Hello, Robert. Thank you for taking my call. Listen, I'm wondering if the Tibetan people are better off without the man named Dalai Lama at the head of their state, which is 300 or so cliques who run the country, and everybody else would surf. So that's basically, if you can answer that, we can decide whether his teachings are any worth listening to. Thank you.
I couldn't quite
he
catch
him.
He was
curious if you felt like the people of Tibet were better off without the Dalai Lama as head of state.
No, they don't think so. I mean, which in my opinion is one thing, and I also don't think so. I don't think so. They don't think so. He thinks so.
The Dalai Lama thinks so.
Yeah, he was happy to resign. I mean, he's retired and he's 82 years old, you know. And he was happy, and he has been trying since the 60s in the government in exile to get the Tibetans sort of more into democracy, you know, and to not be so partisan that, you know, they be a loyal opposition, learn those kind of skills that you need for democracy where you fight to win your election and then you become a loyal opposition, you know, which is essential to democracy, which we have forgotten in America a little bit, unfortunately. And he's tried to train them like that. And they are working on it, you know, the Tibetans. They're not used to that. They're used to having this sort of, like, they're used to having their Jesus figure living there and actually helping them out, you know, like a second coming happened like 1,000 years ago to the Buddhists by the reincarnation thing, you know. And the Avalokiteshvara, you know, Chenrezig, as the Tibetans call him, which the Dalai Lama's incarnation of, as well as some other lamas are as well, because they have multiple incarnation type of ideas of their Messiah figure. But he is that. So they like being led by that, and it helps them keep their own, you know, not get too partisan and too divisive, you know. Well, Tibetans are very individualistic. They're, you know, semi-nomadic, and, you know, they move around, and so they're not so hierarchical oriented. So having such a figurehead is important to them. And they will draft him back as the minute they could. They were very upset that he did resign.
Well, let me tell you, let me put Joel's question to you. He writes, okay, does the Dalai Lama view himself as a failure regarding what China has done to Tibet? The Dalai Lama
He'll say that when he feels a little like down and he admits his failure, but you know, that in the sense that they still haven't changed, you know, he has failed to reach them, he's failed to speak to them. The leaders of the other countries have failed to get the Chinese to decide that it's important to meet with him and to discuss with him, so he calls that a failure. But I don't think he thinks that nonviolence is a failure. He feels that in the long term, nonviolence will work because nonviolence doesn't destroy your enemy, you know. It's kind of Buddha's original thing. You know, people wrongly think Buddhists are want everybody to be poor or something, you know, because they think life sucks, you know, and just want to leave it and get to be nirvana. But not at all. The Buddha was a king who would have been a general of an army and conquered people. You know, that was his job had he stayed in the lay life, you know. But he then became a mendicant. And then the merchant classes benefited from Buddhism enormously. And Buddhist societies prefer that people do commerce. Because the great thing about commerce as opposed to military conquest is that you can increase wealth and your customer benefits by whatever you trade with them. And of course you try to get a good deal and they try to get a good deal. But then you trade again next year. The army guy goes and takes everything from the customer and then kills the customer, basically. So there's no business next year. And that's really not good. So the Dalai Lama, the nonviolence thing didn't work immediately. He often says, well, if you do violence successfully, it seems like you made an immediate good result. But then it always has a bad backlash, you know, a blowback, what you call
it. It feels like you might be addressing, let's see, Laura in Oakland.
Okay.
Hi, Laura.
Hi there.
Hi, Laura.
Hi there. I was just wondering, I read an article about 10 years ago, and it kind of shocked me.
Oh.
And it was interviews with Tibetan women that were still there and whether they felt they were better off. And many of them said, yes, they are, because when the Buddhists were running the country, they were taking 3 and 4 of their boys into the monastery and they didn't have farmhands and they were starving without boys. I wondered if you had a comment on, I've never been able to find the article again because I've had the discussion with many people who have asked me to find the article for them because nobody wants to believe that.
I think that there might be some women with that attitude. And there are some exile women who very much complain about the behavior of some chauvinist Tibetan men. And nobody's saying that all Tibetans are saintly. The idea that, however, because boys would go to monasteries, the people, families are starving, in the old days, in old Tibet, is a little, sounds to me like a little trickle of Chinese propaganda, because actually a Tibetan family was absolutely thrilled if they had a child who could become a monk or a nun and could rise in that way, because you understand there was no, the social mobility in Tibet was through religious education, spiritual education. And that's how, there was no army basically, and there was no way of becoming a hero warrior and then raising the family. So it was an exciting thing. And Tibetan women in general are more spiritual and more religious and devoted than the men even. And they also didn't have just one kid. So, you know, they usually had several. And, you know, one of the boys would be sent off. It would be an honor if they would be accepted and sent off. That was how they would become educated and would raise the entire family. So in general, that was the nature of Tibetan society. And that all the women were sitting there starving because they only had one son, and that one son had to go off to a monastery like somebody came and snatched the boy. That's really not the case, you know. Especially, for example, the idea of if they happened to have a reincarnation, you know, like the Dalai Lama or something. That was like an exciting thing. The Tibetan women would run out and pray every day, please, some bodhisattva come and take residence in my womb so I can be the mother of a great reincarnation. It was a huge social status-raising thing. And so I'm sure there were individual cases where there was some unfortunate family thing, and I'm sure those women were sincere, and I don't know how many of them were saying that. But I don't think that, you know, the Chinese always try to say, oh, the Tibetans are so good, they were so bad. They actually hired Western people in the early years of the invasion and occupation in the 50s to write books about, try to create in the Western mind the idea that Tibetan lamas were kind of like Borgias, you know. They were corrupt, and they found a good audience in Protestant societies that have a certain image of Catholic monks. And, you know, there's a big anti-Catholicism thing somewhere underground in Protestant mentality, in the Protestant work ethic, Protestant ethic. You know, it's an anti-monastic thing. And so then they hired Westerners who were sophisticated about that to write books and create an idea that Tibetans were awful. They had horrible propaganda museums where Tibetan monks were burying babies under the foundation stones of monasteries, and they tried to make it just as horrible as they could to justify their colonial invasion and genocide that they practiced in Tibet, killing a million people out of 600 million, out of 6 million in the first few decades. And so please don't worry so much about it. I mean, in those individual cases, one is very sorry, and nobody says Tibet was perfect. And even Dalai Lama would say Tibet was feudal, which I don't think is actually technically, sociologically correct. I try to tell him, please not to do that. But they certainly had problems, and they certainly would have been happy to have help in reforming them on their own, as everybody does. And they didn't really appreciate becoming enslaved by the Chinese communist bureaucracy.
Well, let me thank Laura for the call and ask you Tony's question. He writes, if the Dalai Lama were truly a man of peace, he would be vegan. How can he claim to be nonviolent if he regularly consumes slaughtered animals? How can he preach compassion if he's complicit in the exploitation of non-humans via the meat and dairy industry?
That's very good. Well, I think dairy is going a little bit far, but meat, I agree. And Dalai Lama agrees, and he appreciates the vegetarianism, and he insists upon it in the monasteries, and he tries to be a vegetarian himself. When he first came to India, he was strict vegetarian under the influence and with the support of some Indian yogis and the Indian vegetable sort of diet sort of thing and rice and dal and whatever. And he got hepatitis, and the Tibetans had like riots about our Dalai Lama. Tibetans need to eat meat. It's our national diet. We're nomads, you know. And the nomads do appreciate their yaks and their animals, but they do eat them because that's what you do in a high altitude steppe where you have very few, not so much gardening. Although when he goes back, Dalai Lama has said that one great thing they have done in Tibet is they've showed Tibetans, but they have done it for themselves, of course, for their own settlers, but they have shown how to make greenhouses where you can actually grow more vegetables and things, and therefore there'd be less reliance on the yak meat. Up there, they didn't like to eat chickens. They would never eat a fish where one life, they didn't eat any fish. They didn't fish in the rivers. They wouldn't, because there you're having a meal of one life, you know. A yak, you can eat a yak for months, many people, you know. And so they try modestly within the sin of taking life to be better. Dalai Lama does not regularly gobble down. He's not a big Texas steak man at all, but occasionally he will have some soup or something, but people will give it to him when they travel. And he's not self-righteous about it when he is vegetarian. And he approves of vegetarian. He thinks people people should be. He follows that whole reasoning that you are making. Although dairy thing is maybe not so clear cut. But industrial dairy farming, yes. But in the old nomad thing where you live with your yaks and you milked your yaks, female yaks, you know, that was something that was cheese and milk was a kindness of those yaks. And nobody could live at the high altitude Tibet without yaks, actually. As the Chinese are discovering where they've killed all the yaks, And they have put the Tibetan nomads in enclosures, just like the Americans put the Indians in their reservations and shot all the buffaloes. But they've done that now. That's happened now, and so that's a very sad thing.
Well,
I appreciate your question, and that is a fault of the Tibetan economy.
Well, let's hear from Neil in San Francisco. Hi, Neil.
Yes, you seem to be condemning all wars and saying that all wars are wrong. I would like to know how slavery or Nazism could have been abolished without war. What does the Dalai Lama think of the concept of self-defense?
Thanks, Neil.
The concept
of self-defense, but also about, you know, there are some things accomplished by war. Say, example, in the Civil War, Nazism is what Neil is pointing out. And so what does the Dalai Lama have to say about that?
Right. Well, what the Dalai Lama has to say about war is like what Jonathan Schell says about war, based on Western sources and von Clausewitz, that in the old days, maybe wars sometimes were useful because, after all, wars were rarely genocidal. Although, you know, Trojan War was genocidal. They genocided the Trojans. They didn't just defeat them and get Helen back. They wasted the entire place. But so there is a kind of ancient theme about the tragedy of war. But on the other hand, people could win and they could make another country do something that they didn't want to do just by defeating the army and a little bit of looting and pillaging, but 95% of the casualties were soldiers. But nowadays, 95% of the casualties in modern war are civilians, and therefore war has no longer a useful purpose. And so he follows that Jonathan Schell, although they independently developed their ideas. He doesn't know Jonathan Schell. But wars are too powerful. Technology is too powerful. So it's necessary for us now. Dalai Lama has the same view as Jesus did and Buddha did, that violence never puts an end to violence. It just creates a cycle of violence that gets worse and worse. And you have to love your enemy, actually. And everybody thinks, oh, that's so nice Jesus said that, but look what happened to him. And they don't really believe it. And that's one of the faults in our Western culture, post-Christian culture, is that we are conditioned to think that goodness is weak and meanness and nastiness is more powerful, render unto Caesar sort of idea. And that makes us then despaired and makes us unable to really manage our democracy because half of us don't vote. And therefore, we get really bad governments. And people think it's no use and it's all hopeless. And they live a life of despair and they gobble down Prozac all in this country by the barrel. And so actually the Buddhist view and Dalai Lama's view is that goodness is more powerful. And yes, it was great to release slaves anywhere. Slavery is completely against whatever. Buddha himself in ancient time, he admitted people from all castes, the low untouchable caste, any caste, into the Buddhist order. It was very revolutionary, but gently revolutionary. He didn't go out and violently kill the kings or kill the slave owners and then, you know, find another form of enslaving the people he just killed. You know, we've seen these violent revolutions against injustice where the new leaders, because they get to the top by violence, are more oppressive than the past leaders. So, you know, Jesus and Buddha were giving practical advice that you have to learn to get along with your enemy in some way while resisting and correcting the negative things that they do. Well, and that's another new way of doing it.
Well, Neil, thanks for the call. Rick writes, Robert Thurman is fascinating this morning. Does he have a book with more of his own thoughts versus this new one about the Dalai Lama?
Oh, that's a question?
For you,
oh,
yes,
I have a bunch of them. Oh, sure. I've been writing. I wrote a book previously to this. My own trilogy, I could say, of what I really think, almost, not quite. Maybe I haven't told, because I've been a professor, so I have to be a little cool. But Inner Revolution, I wrote a book. Then I wrote Infinite Life. And then I wrote, which is like the yoga of the cool heroes of Inner Revolution. And then which described the Buddhism as actually socially powerful. If I must say, I think it was an innovation in Buddhist history and studies by Westerners, in that the previous idea was because they had monasticism, that they didn't have anything to do with society. And they were Max Weber, the great sociologist, a European sociologist, they said Buddhism was socially apathetic, he said. And Western missionaries thought that too. And so that's what West has thought. Whereas actually to develop a monastic system in a society is extremely revolutionary because it takes manpower and wealth and land yield away from militaries and armies. And it tends to, it's the one institution in history that has been able to counter militarism in societies, actually. And that's a sort of sociological theory that I have. And which I think, and the Dalai Lama likes to tease me because I was a monk, then I quit being a monk. And he says, "You're the most enthusiastic about monasticism ex-monk that I know." And, but because it's a sociological enthusiasm. And so inner revolution is changing society by changing them, people's minds, and making a certain sector of them live at a higher level of gentleness and ethicity, you know, ethicality. Mm-hmm. And then create that vibe in the society of people being more kind and more gentle. And take, especially, therefore, it was focused on men who tend to be warriors, you know, and kill people, you know.
Well, we're talking with Tibetan Buddhist scholar and activist Robert Thurman about his new graphic novel, Man of Peace, the illustrated life story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. He'll also be at the Commonwealth Club today at 12:30. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim in today for Michael Krasny. Robert Thurman, where do you disagree with the Dalai Lama on anything, and where is the biggest point of disagreement?
Well, one thing I disagree with him, I disagree with his resigning, not retiring.
When did he do this exactly?
I disagree with that. I say that I think that, you know, there's this notion that because of the need for pluralism, which I agree, we have a notion that bringing spirituality to the fore in a society is going to be dangerous because it's going to lead to a theocracy. And even people will call Tibetan society theocratic. But in a way, theo means God, you know. And so, and Buddhocratic, you can call it. I don't mind that. You know, if you say Tibet was Buddhocratic. Because people are not afraid of Buddha. Buddha's not a big boss and an omnipotent something. He's there. He's urging people to take individual initiative and use self-control. And so I disagreed with Dalai Lama. I think that it's very important to have a spiritual figure who has real profile in a society that people want to deal with if it's not a thing of oppressing the other religions. And even back to the fifth Dalai Lama in the 17th century, he gave land to the Muslims who came to Tibet. He gave land to the Christian missionaries who came to Tibet. They weren't very successful because in a way they're so similar to Christianity and they have a whole thing about compassion and, you know, love, turn the other cheek. They have that whole thing in Buddhism. Not that every Buddhist obeys it by any means. There's some right now in Burma and Sri Lanka, there's some very nasty Buddhists behaving badly.
Yes, well, let me...
We've
had several questions around this. Marty writes, what does the Dalai Lama have to say about the oppression of the Muslims in Myanmar? Donna writes, Myanmar is a majority Buddhist state and it's now being accused of forcing out its Islamic minority.
It's been very
How
bad.
Does this square
it's
with
terrible.
The Dalai Lama's teachings?
And we had a conference. I actually met that guy, Wiratu, who preaches about how we have to get the Muslims. And he wouldn't pay any attention. I told him, Dalai Lama said, please don't do that. If you're beating when you start feeling like beating somebody, think of Buddha's face and how unhappy he would be, since he taught nonviolence so intensely and loving even the enemy, much less the friend or the defenseless person. And, you know, similar to Jesus, you know. And so it's just that, you know, it's like Christianity. Jesus said, turn the other cheek. He didn't say, bomb thine enemy. He said, love thine enemy. And yet you have crusades and things like that. So Buddhists are also human beings, and they've been imperfect in different times in history. But actually, they never did do a major crusade in the name of Buddhism. They're doing these small things that are happening nowadays, both in Sri Lanka, too, was very bad against the Tamils. And then now the Burmese are being bad like that. And then the government, now that before it was the generals, and they didn't do anything to stop it. And then now that Aung San is at least behind the scenes running the country, although she's not the premier, and she's a Nobel Prize laureate and so on, and people and friends of the Dalai Lama say, please do something. She's been unable to do anything. And this is a real disgrace and to Buddhism, and it's terrible. And we totally accept the blame for that. And it's awful. No, there's no rationalization for it. It's just imperfection.
You know, we have just a minute or so left. And one of the questions that really lingers for me frequently when it comes to the Dalai Lama is, yes, what does the future hold
yes.
for annexed Dalai Lama for...
Yes.
Can you just
talk about...
Well,
that's one place I disagree with him. You know, I said the next Dalai Lama, I want him to be a constitutional Lama. You know, I want... And he says,
what does
no.
that mean exactly?
Well, like, you know, like the British king, queen, or the Swedish king or something. Because I feel, you know, we have this problem in America of too much personality, charisma, you know, contest, popularity contest for our presidents. So if you have a monarch of some kind who doesn't have actually real political power but has a modeling power, then you have to have prime ministers where they have to have a program, and they, at least they have to have some qualifications. They can't just go and act like I'm a reality TV star. They can't get away with that because there's somebody else who sets a model for the country, you know. So I think that's where I don't agree with Dalai Lama about that.
Well, and, but the way the system works, forgive me, is that the Panchen Lama declares the next Dalai Lama? Is that correct? Am I understanding
the
system
correctly?
But no, it doesn't necessarily have to be the case.
In the past, Panchen Lama was the most important Lama amongst various sort of Lama committees and psychics and things like that who would recognize the next Dalai Lama. It's quite a process.
I see, yes.
It's a committee process.
But he said, the Dalai Lama, that he could be the last. So in the last 20 seconds.
And he will be? But what he means by that is not that he won't reincarnate. He will. But he'll reincarnate in his monastery. He will not have political responsibility, so social, same kind of social responsibility. And there's a place where I don't agree with him. And the Tibetan people won't agree with him, I can tell you. And because they feel this is very helpful. You know, I said, you know, we had an argument about it, actually. And he said he didn't want to be a prisoner like Princess Di, he said.
Well, Robert Thurman, I will echo an earlier listener and say this has been a fascinating morning for me. Thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, well, thank you.
I appreciate it. Robert Thurman, Tibetan Buddhist scholar. His new book is Man of Peace, The Illustrated Life Story of the Dalai Lama of Tibet. I'm Mina Kim in today for Michael Krasny. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.